To balance or not to balance? That, well, that's one of the questions. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today, 8 February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a not at all random historical fact relevant to the fiscal policy discussions that Congress and the White House are going to be having over the next number of months. The federal budget has been balanced, that is, government revenue meeting or exceeding government spending. It's been balanced exactly twice in the past almost 60 years. Lyndon Johnson in 1969 and Bill Clinton's surplus from fiscal year 1998 to 2001. It wasn't easy then, and it is not going to be easy now, which I mention because balancing the federal budget is a key Republican talking point. So we are going to talk about it a little bit. Linda Bilmes is a senior lecturer at the Kennedy School at Harvard, and she was in the Clinton administration the last time the budget was balanced. Welcome to the program.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
So President Clinton walks into the room, whatever meeting you happen to be in, and says, hey, bring me a balanced budget. Then what happened?
Well, then what happened is he realized that this was going to be pretty difficult. We had 5% of GDP deficit when he took office. But Clinton had the courage to raise taxes and to cut military spending. And he also had the good luck to be president during a benign economic period when we had a tech boom and a peace dividend.
Yeah, so it seems actually that timing for President Clinton was everything as far as it went on being able to deliver on his promise of a balanced budget.
Well, timing was important, but it was not everything. It was Clinton's taxing and spending policies in his first term that laid the table for the budget surplus. But in the second term, when the Republicans gained the House, he and Speaker Gingrich were able to negotiate, which kind of kept some of his controversial but essential tax increases and budget cuts. And Speaker Gingrich had the authority and the majority to be able to deliver Republicans to negotiate a deal.
And as we know, Speaker McCarthy's hold on power is much narrower than Speaker Gingrich's was back then. Let me ask you about the kind of spending the government did back then, specifically the spending on Social Security and Medicare and the social safety net programs, and the chunk of the federal budget they took up then versus now?
Well, entitlements, including Social Security and Medicare and so forth, they are almost two-thirds of the budget. And when we were in office during the Clinton administration, they were less than half. And we also have much bigger national debt due to three large tax cuts during the Bush and Trump administrations and 20 years of war and vast spending on the 2008 financial crisis and the pandemic. So it really is a very different environment. And then, of course, the political situation is different.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of a baseline question, I suppose. But what are the arguments for a balanced budget other than not spending more than you take in?
I think there is no reason why a balanced budget is magic. What standard economics teaches us is that during good times, during boom times, we should try and pay down debt. And during difficult, fragile times, we should spend more to try and take care of our population. And so over the long term, we should be, roughly speaking, in balance. It should be ebbing and flowing. But what's happened is that for a long period of time, we haven't been ebbing and flowing. We have just been flowing.
Yeah. With the caveat that you have been out of government for a good long while, but do you think that it's possible for the Republican Party in the House of Representatives to deliver, as they have promised, a balanced budget in 10 years?
A balanced budget is not an end in itself, but it is certainly possible. And the Congressional Budget Office has published dozens of recommendations on how to do it to close the gap between revenues and spending. And it is possible to do it responsibly, but that involves revenues, which means taxes, as well as spending cuts. And it also involves making some very unpalatable choices and tackling some of the third rails, including entitlements and the military budget. And it also involves being willing to be bipartisan and to come to the table in a way that everything is on the table.
So it sort of sounds like you don't think it can be done.
Well, what I fear is that we will resort to a series of budget gimmicks. It's very easy, if you're looking 10 years out, to make rosy assumptions. If we assume that GDP is going to grow 5% a year and that somehow spending is going to go down over the next few years, we can imagine up a balanced budget in 10 years, but that's not real. To get a real balanced budget, you need to have the courage to make hard choices and the wisdom to negotiate seriously, as well as economic luck.
Professor Linda Bilmes at the Kennedy School at Harvard, also a while ago in the Clinton administration. Professor Bilmes, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Wall Street on this Wednesday. I guess traders finally did register what Jay Powell said yesterday, that interest rates in this economy are going to have to stay higher for longer. He's been saying that for a while. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We spent a lot of time on this program the past couple of years talking inventories, talking about supply chain issues that have left some businesses without enough inventory, and about changing consumer demand leaving other companies with too much. And for businesses in that boat, too much stuff on the shelves, some good news. The most recent Logistics Managers Index shows a lot of companies have been able to clear out extra inventory, so much so, in fact, that they are back to building it up again. In some industries, though, there is still a lot of stuff sitting around doing nothing, not making any money, which is obviously bad for business. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on the inventory bloat beat today.
A lot of the inventory bloat we're talking about is happening at the wholesale level.
So firms that are buying large quantities of product and then reselling them to other businesses.
That's Jason Miller, a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State University. He says a lot of those other businesses, think retailers connected to the housing sector, aren't buying as much from wholesalers right now.
For example, furniture wholesalers, appliance wholesalers, heating, plumbing, air conditioning, and hardware equipment wholesalers.
In other words, this all comes down to where consumers are spending their money. Home sales have been falling over the last year, so people aren't buying as many building supplies or home furnishings. Zach Rogers, a professor of supply chain management at Colorado State University, says the same thing's also happening in electronics, where consumer demand spiked early in the pandemic.
And some of those companies misread that as, well, this is the new normal, so let's ramp up inventories in anticipation of a different growth trajectory than we're really on, and then you're left just with way too much stock on hand.
Rogers says all of that stock, whether it's electronics or building supplies, has something in common. It's expensive. Companies have a lot of money tied up in that inventory. And while that may not be a big deal to larger retailers and wholesalers,
if you're one of those smaller firms and not some giant Fortune 100 retailer, you may not be able to absorb it as well, especially if you don't have the large reserves of cash that all of those big companies built up during the pandemic.
All of that cash that's tied up in inventory isn't being used productively, says Nicole DeHoratius, a professor of operations management at the University of Chicago.
It is capital that's not being used to invest in new parts of the business, to introduce a new product, to pay your employees more.
DeHoratius says getting rid of that extra inventory with discounts, promotions, and advertising is costly too. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Now and then. All right, more than every now and then, honestly. But every now and then, something happens in this economy that leaves you saying, wait, what? Such is the case with natural gas prices, high natural gas prices, to be clear, all across the country, but specifically here in California, where there are reports of people paying twice and in some cases nearly three times what they were paying for this time last year. Nat gas is used for a whole lot of things, heating homes, gas stoves in some of those homes. Also, not for nothing, generating electricity. Marketplace's Lily Jamali covers energy and utilities for us.
In this era of higher costs for seemingly everything, Joshua Fields recently did an audit of his finances.
And I realized my gas bill was upwards of $300.
He says that's compared to about $125 a month around the same time last year. Fields lives just outside of Sacramento, California, and gets his gas from PG&E. His family started trying to conserve.
We put up plastic sheeting to kind of help insulate the house a little bit more. We bought an electric heater. The gas bill was the same price.
Utilities make money from delivering, not selling the gas itself, says Juan Alvarado at the American Gas Association.
We would prefer if natural gas prices were as low as possible.
Because when prices are high, he says,
we don't make a single cent on that.
PG&E and SoCalGas, two of California's largest utilities, cite increased demand due to unusually cold weather as one reason for the spike. UC Berkeley's Severin Borenstein says supply constraints also drove West Coast natural gas prices more than eight times higher than those in the middle of the country.
The problem is that the pipelines that can carry gas from the rest of the country to the West Coast were completely full.
That meant there wasn't enough room to transport more gas from cheaper regions.
At the same time, the West Coast had less gas in storage than it has had in past years.
But consumer advocates suspect that there's more behind high prices than basic supply and demand. California Governor Gavin Newsom is calling for a federal investigation into whether market manipulation, anti-competitive behavior, or other factors are behind the price spike. In Los Angeles, I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up,
homeownership is its own monster.
Yeah, sure is. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 207 today, 0.6%, finished at 33,949. The NASDAQ down 203 points, that's 1.6%, 11,910. The S&P 500 dipped 46 points, 0.1%, 41.17. When Fortune magazine published its Fortune 500 list in May of last year, there were just six black CEOs on that list. The magazine said that if the Fortune 500 grouping was in line with U.S. demographics, there would be more than 65 black CEOs on that list. In the 68-year history of that list, by the way, only 24 black CEOs total. This year now, there are seven. Calvin G. Butler was chosen as CEO of Exelon Group. Five of those companies are publicly traded. Let's check a couple of them. Exelon, which owns several electric and natural gas companies, sold 1.4%. International Flavors and Fragrances, down 0.4%. Lowe's lost 0.9%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The American labor market the past couple of years has been, well, bewildering is one word you might use. Unemployment hit multi-decade highs, now sits at a half-century low. The private sector lost more than 20 million jobs, but by last year had gotten all of them back. Hotels had the lowest occupancy rate since the Great Depression. Now they're full. Airlines de-staffed and then restaffed, which is a wind-up to this. The landscape of what we all do to make our livings has changed a lot. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has this look at the American workplace right now.
The Grinch stole the show at the Children's Theater Company in Minneapolis this past December.
Guess who's back?
The crowds were record-breaking, says managing director Kimberly Motes.
Our holiday production of Dr. Seuss's How the Grinch Stole Christmas had 58,000 people, and from a ticket sales perspective, was our highest grossing show in our history.
But things are not the same as they were.
December of 2019, for example, we had 72 full-time staff. We are currently at 63, so we have not gotten back to pre-pandemic levels.
185,000 people all across the U.S. found new jobs in arts and entertainment in 2022, 8% growth. But the industry as a whole is still 3% below what it was before the pandemic. This story unfolded in one way or another across lots of different industries in 2022. Take mining.
Gold, silver, copper, lithium, cobalt.
Rich Nolan is head of the National Mining Association. Mining and oil and gas extraction gained nearly 50,000 workers last year alone. Its workforce grew 9%. Orders from China are way up.
Demand exploding as they reopen, and the forecast for things like graphite and nickel, you know, growing 40-fold.
But yet again, employment in this sector has not returned to what it was pre-pandemic. In some cases, like mineral mining, we're still just in recovery and will likely get back to pre-pandemic levels very soon.
But on the other hand, there's maybe just some parts of the industries that are just going to have fewer workers moving forward, even if demand has picked back up.
Nick Bunker is head of the hiring lab at Indeed, which is a marketplace sponsor. For example, even though leisure and hospitality employment grew 7% last year, adding more than a million jobs, there are still almost 500,000 fewer people employed in that industry than before the pandemic, and it's not clear they'll fully come back. One of the industries that saw the biggest growth in percentage terms in the entire U.S. economy in 2022 was hotels, where employment grew 10%.
Hotels are hiring, and they're hiring at the highest wages in our history.
Chip Rogers is president of the American Hotel and Lodging Association. There was phenomenal employment growth at hotels, but they're still 260,000 workers short of pre-pandemic times, and the jobs are different.
I think there's a new normal, and it really focuses on food and beverage. Because the business traveler has not returned the way that we experienced it pre-pandemic, the demands for food and beverage inside the hotel have changed dramatically.
Indeed's Nick Bunker says for all their hiring troubles, these industries could have an advantage going into an economic downturn. They're already lean, so layoffs might be less likely.
If they're still trying to catch up to where they were before things slowed down, for the folks they do have, it might be a cushion.
But for all the industries that are rebounding, others are in straight-up decline. Electronics and appliance stores, furniture stores, department stores, they collectively lost more than 80,000 workers last year, and all are roughly 10% below pre-pandemic levels thanks to the shift to buying online. On the other hand, some industries have come out unequivocal winners last year and through the pandemic.
We're hiring like crazy, and we think it's going to keep going.
Matt Vaughn runs the Applied Science and Technology Group at research organization Battelle. The number of workers employed in scientific research and development services grew 21% during the pandemic, more than 6% last year alone.
There's challenges in national security and climate resilience and these transformational opportunities before us in healthcare. And these things require physical sciences.
Between all the industries that lost workers and gained them, the U.S. added 4.8 million non-farm jobs last year. And in the process, the landscape of what we collectively do for work changed.
It's a large-scale restructuring.
Michael Montgomery is Associate Director at S&P Global Market Intelligence.
But the labor market goes through large-scale restructurings all the time. It's just looking back at history, you don't think about them as being a restructuring.
We are in a historic rearranging of the American workforce, and it is not over yet. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Speaking of budgets, as I was with Linda Bilmes at the top of the program, let's talk about ours, American consumers' budgets, that is, which are not, to be clear, analogous to the federal budget. And I guess, really, we ought to do a segment explaining why that is the case. But anyway, we all used credit more last year for everything from bar tabs to butter than we did in 2021. At the end of last year, we had 7.8% more outstanding credit debt than we did a year earlier. So said the Federal Reserve this week. But in December by itself, a month generally known for credit getting a workout, think about all the stuff we're buying, that growth in borrowing slowed. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes spent her day looking at what consumers are thinking right now.
28-year-old Ken Johnson has relied on his credit card the past few years. First, to buy things to make home more bearable. An air purifier. A Roomba. Then, when he was able to go out, he wanted to go out to wine bars and nice restaurants.
Was I responsible? No. But at the time, I was like, you know, it's $200. What's the harm? And then it was $200. What's the harm? And then it was, you know, oh, this is the harm.
Johnson also traveled to be with sick relatives and had some surprise medical bills. He says he ended up with $30,000 in credit card debt and is paying around 20% now in interest. So he's cutting back.
now is that I'm not buying eggs. And I live, you know, 5 minutes from my workplace, so I'm not buying a lot of gas.
There is a car metaphor for this, says David Wessel of the Brookings Institution.
Until recently, the consumer had been like a race car going around the track at a pretty good clip.
Buying a lot of stuff. And because of inflation, all that stuff cost more. Now, Wessel says, people see warning signs on the side of the track.
Recession may be ahead, cost of borrowing going up. And so they're doing the logical thing, which is being a little more cautious.
This is why the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, to make credit more expensive. Bank of America economist Michael Gapin says, as that happens,
you would expect credit growth to slow, but that also may mean consumers get pinched more readily and more quickly. They don't have that financial flexibility that they had before.
That can look like skipping nice dinners and not buying eggs. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Sometimes you're looking for a getaway, you just need a break, but none of the places you can find fit what you want. So, what do? Well, you make your own place, right? Here is an international installment of our series, Adventures in Housing.
My name is Amber Drew. I use she, they pronouns. I reside in Brooklyn, New York, and I'm a co-founder of Apogeo Collective. I honestly didn't start traveling internationally until I got in a relationship with my spouse. We were in places we had to often be sisters or cousins. So, you know, it adds an extra layer of dis-ease to a vacation. But, you know, traveling to places, we stay in a variety of, you know, resorts, hotels, Airbnbs, you know, all different types of homestead spaces. And we would just kind of like take notes, like, this is a really great thing that makes us feel comfortable. This would be cute if they added, you know, this additional thing. And we looked at each other one day, I think we might have been in Italy, and we were like, we could do this. Initially, the idea was creating a collection of like bed and breakfast pop-up experiences catered towards travelers of color, queer travelers of color, and our allies. But the thing is, buying a house and starting this project seems so large and looming. And we actually did a residency in Mexico where we talked about some of the places that we had been and we felt really comfortable. And then talking to one of the folks that ran the residency, she was like, I didn't buy this place, I rented it. And that's when our light bulb kind of went off. Being like, oh, we could rent a space. And then that made the idea feel a lot more feasible. Our first run was in San Juan del Sur, Nicaragua, and Nicaragua was one of our favorite places traveling. And then the idea was to continue hosting these globally and also create some domestically. And then COVID hit, and the pandemic kind of shut down that idea at the time. But when we were in San Juan del Sur, we found some really great opportunities to actually become a homeowner. And we were like, maybe this is the place. We originally were trying to get investors to invest in the idea, but you know, that's a harder pitch. But what we also did in having conversations with some of our folks, they were like, what about crowdfunding? So the crowdfunding campaign is a success, and that helped to pay for over half of the down payment. Homeownership is its own monster. So we are now going into our second year of having the space. And it's been really great and also simultaneously really challenging. You know, one of the things is that we essentially find a home, you know, in each of us. And we're like, let's connect folks who may not have had the opportunity to connect before.
Amber Drew from the Apogeo Collective in San Juan del Sur, Nicaragua. Tell us, would you, about a remarkable house you found or maybe a different kind of adventure in housing. We'll get it on the radio. You can tell us at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which I'll preface by pointing out that the challenges this economy faces right now don't have a whole lot in common with what was going on in 2009, just as we were getting out of the financial crisis. But we are feeling about as bad about our own personal financial situations today as we did back then. The data is from the good people at Gallup, which released a survey today showing that fully half of Americans say they are worse off now than they were a year ago. 35% say they are better off. Perhaps not surprisingly, 61% of lower-income Americans say things are worse now. Just 26% say things are better. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context in which we learned together that the benchmark for egg prices in this economy is something called the Midwest Large White Egg Price. It's from the market research firm Erner Barry. And I told you that just so I could tell you this. A dozen eggs on... Come on, we have a Midwest Large White Egg Index? A dozen eggs on Monday ran you $2.61. That is a 51% drop from the high of $5.40 or so. That was just before Christmas. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. We should do a series on all the indexes we have, actually. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.